when we were born, they tried to cover our eyes. Then they tried to tell us all what to see. We are discovering that did not work, for we were born to be free. It's a gay spirit singing in our hearts, leading us through these troubled times. It's a gay spirit moving round this land, calling us to a time of open love.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT. And frequent listeners of QMH may know that Gay Spirit by Charlie Murphy is one of the songs I've played most over the years. It's from the landmark album from 1979, Walls to Roses. I did an in-depth feature on that album last September, but this time I'm using its opening track to go in an entirely different direction. This is one of those rare shows where I'm not paying tribute to particular artists, but to someone very important who is behind the scenes. Did you ever wonder what a producer or engineer on an album really does, or what the difference is? Well, I'm one of those folks who pay attention to liner notes, such as the liner notes to the Walls to Roses album. And a name that kept coming up again and again in recordings in my collection is Karen Kane. She's both a producer and an engineer, and has had over 200 album credits and countless live shows in her career. She's been at it for more than 33 years, doing her work in Boston, Canada, and now in North Carolina. She's worked with a lot of artists dear to my heart, and we'll talk about many of them as well as the work itself. And later in the show, we've got some before and after clips to show you what magic a good producer and engineer can do. Interviewing her has been on my wish list for quite some time, so let's get to it. Karen, how did you get started doing recording engineering?
I was very fortunate. When I was only 19 years old, I got a job through a family friend. The daughter of my parents had some friends, and their daughter was a studio manager at a studio in Manhattan called Six West Recording. And Six West Recording was a three-room, very busy jingle facility. And Beryl was looking for an assistant studio manager, reception, and I became her assistant. But within a year, she left, and the owners offered me her job. So there I was, 20 years old, the boss at a recording studio. And I learned the business end of it, and I ran the studio, the day-to-day business of the studio. And the equipment was always appealing to me, but there was this unspoken rule that women didn't touch the equipment. And so I didn't go near the equipment. I basically stayed in the business end of things for 3 years. But towards the end, I started to get enough of an interest where I didn't care about that unspoken rule anymore. And I'd come in on the weekends with some friends, some musician friends, and we'd start playing, and I'd start learning how to, you know, I knew enough to just get the mic through the board and hit record on the tape machine. And I'd make these recordings that were very amateur, but I started playing with the equipment. And towards the end of my time there, one of the engineers was sick one day, and there was a recording, like a single mono voiceover track for a commercial. And they said, oh, what are we going to do? We don't have any available engineers. And I raised my hand. I said, I'll do it. And they're like, you'll do it? And, you know, I didn't take myself too seriously at that point, and neither did they. But they thought, okay, I've taught myself enough to just sit in front of a console and record one mono voice. I could do that. So I did do that session, and that was the defining moment of me taking it more seriously. And that was the end of 1973. And I decided to move to Boston. It was a great time in Boston, exciting years for me. and I got a job as a studio manager at a studio called Intermedia Sound. And right away, I started doing practice sessions on off hours. And by 1976, I met Lilith. I met Jaden Sarsaparilla. I can't remember how I met them. It goes a little too far back for me. But early in 76, somehow, because I was one of the only female engineers, I got a job doing live sound for Jaden Sarsaparilla. I mean, they're both very incredible musicians. And at one point, I asked them to be my guinea pigs at the studio so I could practice recording. So I have this very basement tape, Jaden Sarsaparilla tape, that nobody knows exists. It's quite something to hear that tape. The recording is pretty bad. I mean, I was definitely practicing and learning and all that. But they loved the piano. Janet Hood loved the piano at that studio. And they decided to do their album there. So I think it was like spring of 76. They decided to do the album at Intermedia Sound. And I was only experienced enough to be the assistant engineer. And after that album, I asked my boss at the studio to fire me as a studio manager and rehire me as an official apprentice engineer. And he said yes, which was pretty amazing. And that began my career. And I started doing projects for, I did a project for Joanna Kasdan in 1977. I did the Lilith album in 1978. 79, I believe it was 79, I did Maxine Feldman's album. That same year, I believe it was the same year, was the Waltz to Roses project.
So you've just named some pillars of our history there.
Yes.
That you were right in the midst of.
Yes.
We were talking about Jade and Sarsaparilla. That was the name Linda Langford and Janet Hood used for performing, and the name of their first album from 1976, one of the earlier ones to contain, gasp, actual lesbian lyrics. Here's a little of their song, She's That Kind of Woman.
Seen a lot of people, and I've made a lot of friends, and I've been in love with women, and I've been in love with men, but she's the kind of person who's difficult to find, cause she's a
And then on to Lilith. Again, you know, this is like the core of the Boston music scene.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed Beth Courant.
Yes. Yes. And actually, I saw on your site the, of course, I listened to every bit of it, and then I contacted Beth, and we've had a little bit of reunion, which has been really nice. The Lilith album was wonderful for me in that I was doing a full band project.
From that Lilith album from 1978 is the title track, Boston Ride.
Boston Ride. An hour from D.C. I'm gonna fly. Flying high. I can't wait to see you. Ooh.
And basically, Beth and I, you know, the band dynamics were very hard. And Beth and I basically mixed that album and made it happen. So we got very close in that process. And, you know, I listened to it. It's like, not too bad for 1978. You know, it helped them for a while with their career, but they were having such terrible band dynamic problems that they didn't last, unfortunately.
A project that did last was Walls to Roses.
I'll say that project was the next 12 years of my life. Walls to Roses opened up a whole new community for me, both personally and professionally, because I connected to all of these people on such a deep level that the local ones, anyway, all became my family, my crowd, my, you know, and by 1980, I was in a relationship with Marcia Taylor and doing everybody's albums. Willie Sordillo used to joke and call me the sound wizard of the left in Boston, because I did everybody's albums. I did Bright Morning Star albums and Charlie King albums and Fred Small and Willie's albums, and, you know, it just went on and on and on. Basically, I have to give the Walls to Roses collective the credit for me getting better at my work, because the interesting thing about this is that they hired me because they wanted to use a woman in a traditionally male job. And so in the very beginning, I got jobs because I was a woman. Whether I was good or not didn't even matter.
Those lefties.
Yeah, really, exactly. So they hired me because, hey, a woman sound engineer. So I got those jobs, and because of it, and it just kept happening, and I got better and better and better. And I did, you know, God knows how many years, 12 years of all these acoustic albums. But I really have to thank that whole community for my beginnings and all those albums that I did that helped me really become quite good at what I did.
I've always put that album on a pedestal as a landmark album.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this past year, as you know, got to devote an entire show to it.
Yes, I know. I listened to every word of it. It was wonderful. Yeah, it was great.
Thank you. I want to get to Maxine Feldman.
Mm-hmm. Maxine and I hit it off the instant we met. And what was interesting about Maxine is that, well, the story that's interesting is that there was this small label, these two women who started this label, I believe, called Galaxia.
Right.
Yeah. And we really didn't get along with them that well. Meaning that there was a communication gap, or actually, Anna Marie Taylor, I believe, was her name. And I think there was a language barrier. I think she was an Italian woman who, I didn't know how long was in the country, but she, we just didn't connect that well. But Maxine was delighted that they wanted to do an album. And the other thing that was hard is that the women from the label chose a producer for Maxine. And she either did the album with this person or didn't do it at all. So Maxine and I had this joke, and the joke is, and I have an album signed where it says, "To Karen, the best producer a girl could have." And the joke is that her and I produced the album and basically ignored the person who was credited as producer, because I did not get credit as producer. So that was a little hard, but we were delighted to be able to do that project.
Do you have a favorite track from that album that you remember?
A favorite track? Well, Amazon is one of my favorites, and I get to hear, I am very proud when I am at the Michigan Women's Music Festival. There's a opening ceremony of the festival, and the ritual is that Amazon is sung every single year. So for every year for the 23 years I've been going to Michigan, I get to hear Amazon, and I feel very pleased and proud that I was a part of that.
That's got to be quite a moving experience to listen to that there.
Oh, my God. Judith Castleberry usually is the person who does the music for the opening ceremony, and they put together a full band, and it's usually in a reggae format, and it's just wonderful. And it's very moving. I have tears in my eyes when that happens, for sure, especially now that Maxine has passed.
Right. Yeah. I only spoke to her once. I interviewed her, and we just hit it off immediately.
She's that kind of person. She really was.
Amazon women rise. Amazon women weaving rainbows in the sky. Amazon women fly. Amazon women fly. I am and once was called Amazon. Now I am called lesbian. I know that the matriarchy ruled back then. Sisters, the matriarchy's gonna rule again. Amazon women rise. Amazon women weaving rainbows in the sky. Amazon women fly. Amazon.
Of course, that was the classic lesbian anthem, Amazon, by Maxine Feldman. It came from her only album, Closet Sale, from 1979. It pains me that we don't have time for the entire song, but there's just so much of Karen Kane's career to cover that we're not going to be able to play full songs.
Maxine introduced me to Kay Gardner. Kay Gardner, I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was 1980, 81. Kay, once she knew about me, she gave me a small job of transferring some reel-to-reel tapes to cassette. And she would sit and tell me of her plan to write and record a Rainbow Path. And then, of course, we got together and worked on that in 1983, and it was released in 84. That was the beginning of a very, very wonderful relationship, both personally and professionally. But Kay and I were very close. That was incredibly hard.
Kay Gardner passed away in 2002 and was at the forefront of composers creating lyrical music for healing, relaxation, and meditation. Karen and Kay worked on about a dozen albums together over the years. And from that first one, in 1984, called Rainbow Path, is a little of a track called Awakening.
Thank you.
Let's take a step back and tell me the difference between the work of a producer and an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the short answer is that an engineer is responsible for everything technical, and the producer is responsible for everything musical. So there are people who do both, like I do, and so I'm responsible for all of it, musical and technical. And the engineer's job is to record everything as cleanly and accurately as possible. And the producer, you know, if you're going to have a hierarchy, the producer is the boss and tells the engineer what to do. And a producer does things like, okay, your guitar is out of tune, or you're singing flat, or yeah, the track speeds up here, and also works on arrangement changes with songs, which is done before you go in the studio. So the producer sits with the artist and the musicians going into the studio and does pre-production. Pre-production prepares you for the studio, and you work on the arrangements of the song, and you work on rehearsing with the people who are going to perform. Then you go in the studio, and then you join up with the engineer, if there's a separate engineer. And that person is responsible for all the microphones and getting it all recorded as beautifully as possible.
I would think if it's two different people, it could vary from project to project as to who really contributed the most.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. There are, actually, I've heard stories of some very well-known producers who just sat there reading magazines. They got hired because of their fame, and they just sat there reading magazines while the engineer did all the work. So, yes.
Or the engineer knew more.
Or the engineer knew more, for sure. But I've been doing both for quite a while now. I think starting around 1985 or so, I started to feel more confident to do both producing and engineering.
I was going to joke with you that you started in 76, kind of, so this would be your 33 and a third anniversary.
That's true. Whew, it's been a long time.
A couple years ago, I interviewed Trett Fury, who got her start as an engineer on the West Coast, and she talked about this, so I can't leave out this question. In the 70s, for a woman to have a recording career was just out of the question.
I have a few stories that show how hard it was. Now, at one point, Intermediate Sound, where we did the Jaden Sarsaparilla and I did Joanna Kasdan's album, by the end of 1977, the studio got sold and I got laid off. And I went to every studio in the state of Massachusetts for a job as an engineer. And I got one offer. And that offer was to be a studio manager, not an engineer. Nobody would hire me as an engineer. So I said, screw everybody. And I took a little ad out in what was called then Musicians Magazine in Boston, just a little local publication. And I took an ad out saying, freelance engineer available. And I have been freelance since that day. And I struggled with not having enough work at times, but it built up and up with the help, of course, of my new community, all the folkies. The advertising was very helpful. And I had this very well-known saying in my ad, unbiased advice about recording and recording studios. Because I didn't work for any particular studio. I went from studio to studio to studio to studio, depending on the needs of the project. And it worked. People called me, and I started to get gigs. Here's a story. In the early 80s, I worked at a studio called Euphoria Sound, where Rainbow Path was recorded. And I'm sitting at the board, doing a session. And I'm obviously doing engineer's work. And there was another session scheduled in for the evening. And some guy opens the door to the control room, comes in, looking all around, looks me straight in the eye, sitting at the board doing work, and says, "Where's the engineer?" So, I mean, the awareness, mm-hmm. you know, was not there.
I was going to ask if you also experienced, not only because of being a woman, did you experience resistance in getting jobs for being a lesbian?
I would say no. It was more the female thing.
And I bet many of my listeners would be surprised to know that Karen engineered the first demo done by Tracy Chapman.
Aha. So I believe it was 1986. And a photographer friend named Susan Wilson, very well known in Boston, called me up and said, "I want to make a demo. There's this young woman that I want to record." And I said, "Fine, okay." And we go to the studio, and Tracy walks in and gets to the microphone, and I am floored, of course. She did four songs. Revolution was one of them. For My Baby, I think, was another one. Can't quite remember all of them. And I remember thinking, this would be a good time to start a record label, and she would be the first person I would sign. I knew it instantly that she had star quality. Instantly. Now, I don't know how much influence Susan Wilson had on the rest of her career, but Tracy was living with a college roommate, and her roommate's father is very big in the industry in L.A., and that's how that happened. I think the roommate heard the demo, and you know, the demo, all the local Boston stations started playing it. And I kicked myself for not having a copy of it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I did ask the question.
Yes, you did. And I think the rest is history.
One of my icons is Alex Dobkin.
Mmm. Oh, yes. I had an incredible experience by being flown to Australia to record Yahoo Australia. And I have a funny story about that. So I get flown to Sydney, and I meet up with Alex and her entourage. This was 1990. I had found somehow the name of a recording truck, and I faxed them and asked them if they could record at this certain venue, and they said yes, and okay, we set it all up. So then I get to Sydney, and we did an afternoon show, I believe, and an evening show. And during the evening show, I'm in the truck with the guy who owns the truck, or the assistant, I'm not sure who it was, and he goes, "What's this over here?" And he hits a button, takes the recording machine out of record. So we're missing some bars of her concert. And so, you know, we put it back in record, and then I had to do an edit. I had to take those many measures from the afternoon show and insert them into the evening show. Because the afternoon show was really just a backup, because we'd have a larger crowd in the evening show. We wanted the evening show would be the main album. And so I edited the afternoon show to the evening show, and the remarkable thing is, if the tempo isn't the same, it would sound terrible. But Alex is so steady that it worked.
And the background ambiance was compatible, I guess.
It was compatible enough in just a few measures.
How many seconds are we talking, roughly?
We're talking anywhere between 5 and 10 seconds.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think anyone would notice. I can't even remember what song it's on. If I heard the album, I would not have a clue.
Yeah, you did such a good job, you couldn't find it.
Exactly.
Here's part of the title track from the album Yahoo Australia by Alex Dobkin.
South is cool, north is warm, May and autumn is the norm. No Big Dipper or evening star. The Southern Cross tells me I'm far from home. With dingoes and koala bears, land of kangaroos, emus, wallabies, and kookaburras in the old gum trees. And I'm falling for Australia. I'm singing gooey-doo, women of Australia. Say g'day, love your lingo, full on doiks, good on ya girls, mind those hooning daggy yabbas. Oh, what do you reckon? How you going driving on the left-hand side? Love your big wide scrappy style, rave on conversations. I couldn't get a word in Yahoo Australia. Australia, dingoes and koala bears, land of kangaroos, emus, wallabies, and kookaburras in the old gum trees, and I'm falling for Australia. I'm singing gooey-dooey, women of Australia.
Again, that was Alex Dobkin. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as visual as well as an audio experience. And this is another one of those shows where I had much too much great material for just 1 hour. So you can find part two on my site. I had to make some very painful decisions on who had to move to the second hour, and that included hearing about Karen's work with some terrific artists like Suede, Fred Small, Wishing Chair, Ember Swift, Alex Olsen, and others. See what I mean? So you can find a second hour of this show on my site. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Karen, how does live sound engineering differ from the studio?
Well, it differs a lot. The skills are a little different, although I do quite a lot of live sound and enjoy it a lot. A lot of live sound engineers have never been in a studio, so they don't know about, you know, the recording programs today, or back then they didn't know, for instance, how to calibrate a tape machine. They didn't know the difference between, you know, this studio mic and this studio mic, and there's a lot of things about the studio that you don't get to learn when you're at a concert. And there are lots of live sound engineers who do studio work, but I was doing both early on, so that's why I was able to do both. But some can't. A live sound engineer who's never been in a studio couldn't just come into a studio and start working it. However, a studio engineer could very easily, once all the equipment's all set up, go to a live sound gig and start mixing.
No retakes live, though.
No retakes live, that's for sure. And dealing with feedback is something, very annoying thing, you know. It's a skill to learn how to do that. You don't have to deal with that in the studio. So that's something that would be hard for a studio engineer who doesn't have that much live experience.
A very prominent live recording was NWMF, National Women's Music Festival, their silver anniversary.
that was a fantastic project. I recorded and mixed that. And I got to hire, because the budget was decent, I got to hire a wonderful recording truck out of Chicago. A wonderful guy. They were so good. They let me take over, and I did the whole thing, and they just helped me in whatever way they could. It was a wonderful experience, and then I got to mix all of it. It was quite a long project. It was great. As opposed to the Diketones, the guys we hired for the Diketones recording, you know, that was in P-Town. And we hired a well-known live recording engineer and a truck. And I thought to myself, oh, I'll learn a lot from them. Well, as it turns out, they came to P-Town and thought they were on vacation. They'd be hanging out in the bars and the restaurant when they're supposed to be sound checking with me. You know, they really took advantage of the situation, and it was, and I had to take over, which I did, because they'd rather be on vacation.
I don't remember seeing that on your album list.
You know what? Here's an interesting thing about that. And I'm gonna fix this. I think initially when I put my website together, which was a long time ago, 10 years or more, yeah, like 12 years, I was slightly homophobic about the name myself. I didn't want to come out on my website because I wanted, I don't know why, but I'm going to rectify that, actually. I'm going to put it in there. Thank you for bringing that up.
And she did add the Diketones to her website's discography. The fabulous Diketones released one album called Live in P-Town in 1988. When I did a feature interview on them on my February 2005 show, I played quite a few songs by them, but didn't have room for this oldie but goodie, 16 Candles.
Happy birthday.
Okay, before we got distracted by the Diketones, and that's an easy thing to do, we had been talking about the live project Karen engineered. It was called NWMF Silver and was the 25th anniversary celebration of the National Women's Music Festival. And that year must have been terrific, with Chris Williamson, Trett Fury, Farron, Teresa Trall, and Zrazy, among others. And one of those others was Janis Ian.
That was a real highlight for me, doing that album. Working with Janis Ian was a dream for me because she's, I think, by far my favorite songwriter of all time.
Wow.
When she came out with that album Breaking Silence. I was blown away by that album, and I used it for a lot of things. That album became not only for my personal pleasure, but I used it as a reference for myself to get inspired in the studio. And I would use it to compare what mixes I was doing to her mixes, because I loved that album in many ways, musically, recording-wise, mixing-wise. And so it became a very important album to me.
How was the interaction at the actual event?
Well, that, talk about a highlight, was really special for me, because I was honored and delighted to have a chance to work with Janice Ian. You know, it wasn't Janice Ian who hired me for the album. It was the producers of the festival, and she happened to be in the lineup. But we connected really well because we had a chance to have some personal hangout time, and we found out we had a lot in common. We were born in the same year. We both are Jewish. We both grew up in New York. And so we had a lot in common. So we hit it off. Professionally, we also had some personal contact because she had to approve the mixes before the producers could use the recording to and then get the CDs pressed. So I had some professional interaction with her, as well as personal. It just was a thrill for me.
From NWMF Silver, here's a little of Hunger by Janice Ian. That's beautiful. Just part of the almost 8-minute performance of that song by Janice Ian at the National Women's Music Festival. Early in the show, I mentioned that you would get to hear the before and after difference in the work Karen does. She sent me a very raw track called Free from the latest album by the duo Someone's Sister. Let's talk about Someone's Sister.
Yay! Someone's Sister have become very good friends of mine. They live very close to me. And their second album has just been out not that long, the new album. And Georgia Winfrey and Catherine Jones are incredible together. And they would give me, they'd give me demos that I would listen to, and I would choose the song. And I'd say, I like this one, I like this one, I like this one, and so on. And, of course, they had a say in it, but they wanted to know what I thought. So then we would all agree on the song. And then we would go into pre-production. And the demo I sent you has a rehearsal of one of the songs called Free. That's the first cut of their new album.
Well, this is cool. Karen sent me a demo and also sent me the finished track so my listeners can hear the difference. Can you talk about what you did to get it to the finished product?
Well, first of all, the difference between a rehearsal demo is that the recording is a, you know, low quality home recording, so that the studio quality difference is going to be outstanding. And the musicianship of all the hired musicians is incredible on the album. And the song Free, there's some different vocals in there that are not on the demo, and vocals are obviously their strong suit.
I think they're added layers of percussion and so forth.
Yeah, and a lot of layers of guitar work. Yeah, it's a great song.
Okay, here's the very before version of the song Free, and then the finished product.
You left me with wounds no one can see. Now I try to heal them, but it's killing me. To rescue the child, so lost at sea. To awaken the woman that lives in me. Feels like I am free. Revelling in the morning sun. Now I know I'm not the only one.
And here's where we switch over to the album version.
Want to hear more? That's from the brand new album by Someone's Sister, Calm in the Chaos.
And you can hear another example of before and after work by Karen on a song by another artist if you tune in to part two of this interview on my website. I hear a lot of albums, especially by bands, where I think, gee, I wish I could understand the words better.
Well, that happens a lot. I think one of my specialties is dealing with vocals and coaching singers for them to not only sing in tune, but just the expression. And when I mix, I make sure every word is heard. If I have to sit there and program in to bring up, you know, the end of a word, I do that for every vocal. You want to know what they're singing about.
I don't want to leave out your nominations for Juno Awards, which are Canadian Grammys.
Oh, yes, the Canadian Grammy. I was just so elated to have, I believe I have three of them now. Jack Grunsky. Jack is a children's artist, so it was for the Best Children's Recording. That was my first Juno nomination. He did not win. None of them won, but, you know, it's an honor to be nominated. Then Big Daddy G, unfortunately... Oh, that was so sad. February 24th, Dave Glover got killed in a car accident. The Big Daddy G guy. So we're all kind of mourning that. But his blues album, Best Blues Album of the Year, got a nomination. And then Harry Manx, more acoustic blues. You know, acoustic guitar, bluesy, great voice.
I'm down to the last song. This went way too fast, and I want to thank you all for listening and Karen Kane for the delightful interview. You can find out more about her work at her website, www.mixmama.com. And you can find much more about this interview on my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I'm closing the show with an artist out of Toronto who released a CD EP in 2008 that Karen produced and engineered. The CD's title is I Am Who I Am, and of course the title track has an anthem quality to it, just perfect for this show. I would like to hear about your working with Anna Gutmanis.
Anna called me. Actually, she emailed me and said, I have this project I want to do. Can you refer me to any female producers in Toronto? And I wrote her back and said, no, not really. I didn't really know anyone who was female who was doing what I do there, believe it or not, in a huge city like Toronto. I really couldn't come up with anyone that would fit in, because she actually really wanted to work with a lesbian. So I wrote her back and I said, you want me? And she wrote back and said, okay, what do I have to do? And I said, you just come to Wilmington. And so she came to Wilmington. I hired some musicians. We recorded at the bigger studio here and mixed it at home, and away she went. And, you know, this great songs that she did. She's a great musician.
In particular, can you talk about her song, I Am Who I Am?
Mm. Well, that's a song that's angry and needs to be out there. It's a great song.
I'm thinking of ending the show with that song, because I want something that is really more up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty up.
Yeah, you know? Really?
Yeah, I mean, it has that angry, I am who I am, damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lyrics are terrific, and it's a great song.
Things I thought nobody gonna take away my freedom. You and me, my friends and I should leave. You're gonna have to fight us every hypocrisy. It's hatred of yourself that you